An effort is on to bring the monarch butterfly back to Massachusetts. Local agencies today announced a grant partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to create habitats for the monarch, as well as bees and other pollinating insects. Joining us this morning to talk about how they'll do that and why is Colleen Scully with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Good morning, Colleen, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell us what's going on with monarch butterflies, and why are we trying to bring them back to Massachusetts?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a national effort with many partners to try to improve and expand populations and restore the monarch butterfly throughout the United States. And we're excited to be partnering with the Massachusetts Division of Fish and Wildlife and the Massachusetts Department of Transportation to expand and improve monarch habitat in Massachusetts.
Well, before we talk about that, let me ask you, what's happening with the monarch? Why are their numbers dwindling?
In the last 20 years, monarch populations have declined by about 90%. And those declines are from a mix of challenges. One challenge is habitat loss and fragmentation, including loss of their host plant, the milkweed plant. Disease and parasites are a problem. And finally, the use of pesticides and weed control has adversely affected monarchs.
All right, so how do we bring them back?
Well, I guess the message that I most want to say is that everyone can play a role in this. And the primary way we bring them back is by bringing back their habitat and by bringing back their host plant, which is the milkweed plant. By planting pollinator-friendly plants that are native, we are able to restore both monarch populations and a whole host of pollinators.
What is it about the milkweed plant that attracts monarchs?
Well, as you probably know, if you think about a butterfly life cycle, there's an egg, there's a caterpillar, or a larval stage, and then there's the adult, the beautiful butterfly that we think about. For monarchs, the only plant that the caterpillars eat are native milkweed plants.
So we're going to plant milkweeds here in Massachusetts.
What the grant will do is provide funding through the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife to the Department of Transportation, and they will plant a pollinator seed mix. So the seed mix will include milkweed plants and other host plants for other pollinator species.
It sounds like a public program. How can individuals who maybe have a large enough yard to plant these plants themselves participate?
The most important thing to know is whenever you're landscaping, the use of native plants and plants that are indigenous to New England will benefit all pollinators, including monarchs. And there's a couple of great resources. The New England Wildflower Society in Framingham and their website provides tons of resources for private landowners to find out what plants are wildlife-friendly and pollinator-friendly and monarch-friendly and where they can find them. In addition, the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife at their Westboro field headquarters will be developing a pollinator demonstration plot. So the public will be able to go there beginning this fall and see an actual pollinator garden and learn more about how they can make them.
Colleen Scully, very good luck to you in trying to bring back the monarchs. They're so beautiful. We hope it works. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Colleen Scully is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Even those who are not doctors know about the long, stressful hours physicians in training work during their intern and residency years. While there have been a number of studies on how those long hours affect patients, there's been a push recently to investigate how the shifts affect the well-being of the medical residents. WBUR's Rachel Paste reports.
When Brigham and Women's researcher Dr. Douglas Mata began searching for research on depression in residency a few years ago, he was surprised to find that no comprehensive studies existed. So he set out to do one himself.
We found about 54 studies that we extracted data from and combined together, and then we were able to show that overall the prevalence of depression or depressive symptoms is about 29%. Among residents, which is a huge number.
In fact, figures from the National Institutes of Health show it's more than four times higher than the percentage of the general American population that has depression. Mata is himself a resident. He switched to pathology from a urology residency after a depressive episode of his own.
There were a lot of different reasons for it. One is that a colleague of mine, unfortunately, had committed suicide shortly before I started. And then on top of that, there was the stress of having moved across the country and, you know, lost that support group that used to be around me when I was a student.
The suicide of a friend, as well as the death of a relative, also triggered a depressive episode for Dr. Elizabeth Poorman, who just completed her residency at Cambridge Health Alliance.
I felt like, you know, water was rising, and I was staying afloat, and then I was in it, and it didn't matter what I did. I was still completely disconnected from any kind of happiness, and it didn't feel like it was going to end.
Dr. Poorman says it took her a few months to get proper treatment, but when she did get help, those in charge of the residency program helped her schedule therapy sessions into her work week. She says she didn't seek help immediately because she, like many other residents, was concerned about the stigma attached to admitting she had depression, about the fear of being judged by peers, and issues of confidentiality. And, she says, her depression wasn't affecting her work.
Our whole lives are work. So as long as you're able to get up and go to work and work these 16-hour shifts and do a good job, which I feel like I was doing at least a decent job, then it's fine. Then it's not a disorder. It's just, you know, some variation of normal life experience.
This is something hospital management and state medical officials are trying to change. Board of Registration and Medicine Chair Dr. Candace Sloan urges doctors to get help for mental health issues early.
That's why our application says you don't have to tell us unless it's going to involve patient safety. So that is a way of us saying, go get the help before you have a problem. It is always better to prevent or to treat early.
Depression isn't the only mental health issue affecting residents. Dr. Breeze Keeley, who is a resident at Mass General Hospital, says she had what's known as an acute stress episode. She describes it as a sort of mini PTSD.
So I lost a lot of weight in a very short period of time. I was probably sleeping like 2 hours a night, but I was having like terrible dreams and waking up from like these nightmares like every hour. And then physically, I felt like my limbs were numb. I didn't feel in my body at all. And I felt scared.
Dr. Keeley says the stress episode lasted only 2 weeks, but it affected Keeley's work and a patient after she missed some warning signs of looming kidney failure in the man's lab results.
I shouldn't have let it slip, you know? And I just didn't realize. And I didn't realize that the days had passed and I hadn't looked at those labs. And that was terrible.
The patient survived, and Keeley learned that she and all physicians need to seek help at the first sign of a problem or episode that might affect patient safety. She says that when she approached her supervisors, they quickly linked her with a therapist, and she began to get better. While doctors Keeley and Poorman spoke up about their depressive episodes, many doctors keep silent. Even Dr. Sloan of the Board of Registration and Medicine recognizes the challenges in getting physicians to admit when they might need help.
We're taught we have to almost be superhuman. People who pick medicine tend to be people who want to care for others. They want to be the caregiver. They don't want to take care of themselves. They're not thinking about themselves. They're thinking about everyone else.
And at Cambridge Health Alliance, Dr. Poorman says she's encountered peer pressure among some residents.
A lot of medicine doctors that I had talked to, internal medicine doctors, would say, oh, you know, this is just residency. Residency is terrible. Everyone feels terrible all the time. It'll get better. But I think that that's a really dangerous message. It was certainly a dangerous message for me because I had a very treatable condition, but I was getting the message that I should just grin and bear it, that it would magically kind of, you know, get better on its own. And I think it's very clear from the research, too, that that's not the case.
Hospitals are working to replace that message with another one. Get help, and get help early. Dr. John Herman is Associate Chief of Psychiatry at MGH and Medical Director of the Partners Employee Assistance Program.
There can be a point where white-knuckling it through is neither good for yourself nor optimal for patient care. It's not that you can't gutball it through this, but you don't have to.
Dr. Herman says the motto of his program and message he hopes to share with struggling doctors is don't worry alone. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Rachel Paste.
It's time now for the Remembrance Project, writer Alyssa Eli's weekly look at the lives of people who've passed. This morning, she remembers the importance of music in the life of a woman from Winchester.
Vera Fortunato, known to her fan club as Vera Vaughn, was a tenor saxophone player and bandleader, living at all times, as her son Charles Fortunato remembers, in the heart of her music.
There was no disputing anything she said in regard to music. It was just as though she knew it organically.
Hungry for bookings in her early days, Vera used to hang in the New York Musicians' local 802 Union Hall. By the time she decided to create her own swing band in the mid-40s, she was so well-regarded that the lineup filled effortlessly. Vera Vaughn and her stylists in rhythm, as they were called, was all male except for its namesake, who conducted and played and sang. She was the beautiful linchpin. They modeled themselves after Glenn Miller, with an emphasis on lush woodwinds and sax. Fans showed for weekly Friday night performances. Some met and danced, others met and married. The stylists in rhythm toured the New York area for several years. After they disbanded, Vera played down south, this time in an all-women band, mostly for GIs. They were trained to perfection, like synchronized swimmers.
Man, this was not amateur stuff in any way. This was, golly, it was military precision that these all-girl orchestras would perform, section after section, standing again in turn, under the spotlight and working in unison.
Evening gowns and explicit glamour were expected. And yet, extroverted showmanship ran against her character.
In a social gathering, she had no desire whatsoever to stand out. She indeed felt very comfortable, more as literally a wallflower, the wallpaper.
When Vera gave up performing for marriage and family, she played for the audience of herself.
She was very clever about building in music time to whatever household task she was doing. Her favorite kind of housework was laundry, because she'd toss the clothes in the machine, which then allowed her 20 minutes solid of sitting at the piano and accompanying herself.
For her 90th birthday, family arranged a surprise visit to a local orchestral swing night.
And so she came in, sat down after the first number, watching everybody dance. The band leader announced the next song was dedicated to Miss Vera Vaughn, one of us, one of our own. That's how he phrased it.
I'm a fool to wander.
Miss Vera Vaughn, a master in their midst.
Writer Alyssa Eli, remembering Vera Fortunato, who was still teaching music to others until her death in April at the age of 90. To suggest someone for remembrance, email remember at WBUR.org.
To share a tear.